welcome to the Book Report. Or shall I say howdy? Today we're hitching on our saddlebags and traveling west to Big Sky Country, Montana, Wyoming, Texas, Arizona. We'll sample new titles about cowboys who climb into the saddle ready for the ride. And we'll preview books about gals and gents who put their lives on the line searching for justice. I'm thrilled to welcome C.J. Box back to the Book Report. We'll learn about the new Joe Pickett adventure. He's a Wyoming game warden whose stories are always one hell of a ride. But before we get started, can you name the famous cowboy who wrote, "There is something about the outside of a horse that is good for the inside of a man"? Was it Judge Roy Bean, the Duke, Will Rogers, or someone else? Muse it over, and I'll share the answer at the end of today's show. So let's get started as we turn to page one of the Book Report. Evoking the iconic characters and legends of the Wild West, Larry McMurtry's The Last Kind Word Saloon is the story of the closing of the American frontier, as experienced through the travails of two of its most immortal figures, Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday. Opening in Longgrass, Texas, not quite in Kansas, nearly New Mexico, the taciturn Wyatt whiles away his time in between bottles. The dentist-turned-gunslinger Doc is more adept at poker than extracting teeth. Wyatt and Doc are living out the last days of a way of life that is passing into history. Two men never more aware of the growing distance between their lives and their legends. Along with Wyatt's wife, Jessie, we meet an English baron, an exotic courtesan, a Texas ranger, and the witty and irrepressible heroine of telegraph days. McMurtry traces the friendship of Wyatt and Doc from the town of Longgrass to Buffalo Bill's Wild West show in Denver, and on to Texas, finally to Tombstone, culminating with the famed gunfight at the OK Corral. Tom Stetschulte narrates.
Doc drew his pistol and aimed at the hat, but didn't shoot. "Why would a grown man want to be a dentist anyway?" Wyatt inquired. "Well, for one thing, the cost of equipment is low," Doc told him. "All you need is a pair of pliers and maybe a chisel for difficult cases." At the mention of a chisel, Wyatt turned pale. He had always been squeamish. "I'm sorry I brought it up," he said. "Are we going to sit here and let the good doctor's hat blow clean away?" A crow flew over. Doc shot at it twice, but missed. Wyatt walked out in the street and picked up the hat. Across the street at the establishment called the Orchid, a tall woman in a purple dressing gown came out onto a little balcony and shook out her abundant black hair. "There's San Saba. What do you think about her?" Doc said. "I don't often think about her," Wyatt said. "Jessie's all the female I can handle, and it ain't 100% that I can handle her." Just then, they heard a faint sound from the empty plains to the south of town.
"There's supposed to be a herd coming in today from Texas. I expect that's it," Doc said. "Where's your six-shooter?"
"It might be behind the bar," Wyatt said. "It's too heavy to carry around. If I see trouble springing up, I can usually borrow a weapon from Wells Fargo or somebody."
"Bat Masterson claims you're the best pistol shot in the West," Doc said. "He says you can hit a coyote at 400 yards.
Hell, I couldn't even see a dang coyote if it was that far away unless they painted it red," Wyatt said. "Bat should let me do my own bragging if he can't manage to be credible."
"All right, then. What's the farthest distance you could hit a fat man?" Doc persisted, determined to get at least the elements of conversation out of the taciturn Wyatt, who ignored the question.
In the distance, it was just possible to see mounted figures urging their horses at a dead run toward Longgrass.
"Those cowboys have probably been on the drive 30 or 40 days," Doc said. "They're going to want whiskey and whores and want them quick."
Just then, there was a piercing whistle, followed moments later by a train from the east. The train had many empty boxcars and two passenger cars and a caboose. As soon as it came to a complete stop, a skinny young man got off carrying a satchel.
"There stands a dude of sorts," Doc said. "Wonder what the state of his molars might be."
"Now, Doc,
Don't be yanking teeth out of tourists, Wyatt said, turning pale again at the mere suggestion of dentistry. The rumble to the south had diminished. For a time, it faded altogether. The cattle smelled the water. They're over at the river filling up, Doc said. The whores can sleep a little longer. If you had 20 pearls, would you give at least one or two to Jesse? Doc inquired. Wyatt ignored the question. His wife's taste for finery was none of Doc's business that he could see. One of the passenger cars was considerably fancier than the other. It was painted a royal purple. The skinny young dude took a moment to get his bearings and then came resolutely up the street. I wonder who's in that blue car, Doc said. You don't often see a car that fancy in these parts. He happened to glance to the south, where he saw two riders approaching. Wyatt noticed the same thing. Uh-oh, Doc said. Just then, Doc Featherston, owner of the Bouncing Bowler, walked out of the orchid and fell flat on his face in the street.
That was a sampling of The Last Kind Word Saloon by Larry McMurtry. C.J. Box is a Wyoming native. He's worked as a ranch hand, surveyor, fishing guide, a small-town newspaper reporter, and editor. An avid outdoorsman, CJ has hunted, fished, hiked, ridden, and skied throughout Wyoming and the Mountain West. And lucky for thriller lovers, he's the best-selling author of 18 novels, including the Joe Pickett series. He's won the Edgar Allan Poe Award for Best Novel and the Anthony, the McCavity, and the Gumshoe Award, among many others. Over 6 million copies of his novels have been sold in the U.S. alone. Today we'll welcome CJ back to the program to speak about Endangered, number 15 in the Joe Pickett series. Hello, CJ, and thank you so much for joining us again on the Book Report.
Well, thank you. Thanks for having me back. I appreciate it.
Tell us about Joe Pickett and how he has evolved from book 1 to book 15.
Well, Joe Pickett is a Wyoming game warden, and game wardens in Wyoming have huge districts and territories, in this case, 5,000 square miles. And game wardens are charged with enforcing the game and fish regulations of the state, but they're also involved in all sorts of other things, crimes. They assist state patrol, they assist local law enforcement. And Joe Pickett was introduced in the very first book, Open Season. And that's because what I was very interested in writing about was how the endangered species law sometimes goes awry on the ground where it's intended. And in order to write that story, I originally had a sheriff and then a journalist as a protagonist, but I realized that a game warden would be a much better conduit into that story because they would be involved with it in the field. And luckily, when the publishers decided to publish it in New York, they wanted two more books with Joe Pickett, and the series was born from there. And now we're at book 15.
Right. And how central are environmental issues to the popularity of the series?
They're integral to it. I always start with that. I have since the very first book, is I figure out which issue I want to research and make it about, and then I figure out a plot, in effect, to pull a reader through that issue or controversy in what I hope is a page-turning way. In Endangered, the issue is sage grouse, which is a chicken-sized bird that is in 7 or 8 western states that may be declared endangered by the federal government. If that happens, it would really affect the economies of all of the states, most of all Wyoming, which has half of the sage grouse in the U.S.
I have to tell you, lots of us East Coasters get totally freaked out by the thought of survivalists holed up in the woods. We automatically think Ted Kaczynski. Are Westerners more tolerant of recluses, and if so, why?
Well, I think they are because they've always been there. You know, when it's the end of the road, that tends to be where the most extreme of the people kind of gather. And if people want to be survivalists and hole up with their guns, they naturally kind of head west. And they're out there. You know, I've seen them. I've met them. I used to interview them. There aren't lots of them, but there's enough. And part of it is because everyone's very tolerant of you know, guns and individuality. So it's not that unusual.
You write that Wyoming has a larger per capita membership in the Tea Party than any other state. Is that factual? And if so, how scary is that?
Well, I've seen that statistic. I can't vouch for it, but I included it in the book because I thought it was interesting.
And frightening. Is there actually a group called the 9/11 Truthers, people who believe Bush and Cheney brought down the Twin Towers so they could invade Iraq for oil?
Absolutely there is. Yes, they're all over the place. I mean, what I mean is there are the truthers are in across the country. It's definitely a thing.
Well, Endangered has a truly twisted bad guy, the hideous and horrible Brenda Cates. I've often wondered, when you start writing or when ideas start percolating for a new story, does the villain ever come first?
Yes, the villain does come first because I build it from there. What's important, I think, and what I try to do and what I enjoy doing is to create a real legitimate motivation for the bad guy. Not that, not to sympathize with him or her, but so that the reader kind of understands why they do the thing they do. In this case, Brenda Cates is kind of like a Ma Barker type who has her clan outside of town and pretty much manipulates and orders around her sons and her husband because she feels that the local community really doesn't respect them. And she has a chip on her shoulder, and she's upset the fact that her rodeo cowboy son is not celebrated in the community like she thinks he should be.
Right. She's a bad girl. We're speaking with C.J. Box on The Book Report. In the book series, Joe ages in real time. Are there special challenges in writing this way?
I think there's special challenges because, you know, people in real life grow, change, mature. But I find it keeps the series interesting for me because both Joe Pickett and his family have grown and aged from the very first book. His oldest daughter, Sheridan, for example, who's very important in the very first book, she's 7 years old then, and in Endangered, she's a junior in college. So by kind of growing up with the family and having their personalities develop and be affected by things that happen in previous books, I think is rewarding for the reader, and it's fun for me to write.
Yeah. CJ, you have daughters. How scary was it for you to have Joe's oldest daughter horribly attacked at the start of this book?
Oh, it's scary. You know, it's every parent's nightmare, really. When your kid doesn't arrive home on time, and the phone rings, conjure up the worst possible scenario. And to pick up that phone and find out it's law enforcement on the other end is, I think, scares every parent.
The governor of Wyoming is a recurring character in the series. Have you met Wyoming's current governor, and is he anything like Rulon?
No, I've certainly met Wyoming's governor and the previous governor as well. And no, they're not like that at all. But they enjoy the characters. They read the books. And the previous governor thought it was kind of based on him, which is what it was. I like the fact that they do follow the series.
Right. Are you involved at all with the production of the audio editions? I noticed that David Chandler has narrated the Joe Pickett series. Do you discuss the book with him before he begins it?
You know, I've never met him or talked to him.
Wow.
What I do know is that people who listen to his narration of the books really enjoy him. And I hear that all the time, and I'm pleased.
Right. Joe Pickett is such a great character. Are there plans to bring him to TV or to a movie?
There's a team of producers headed up by executive producer Robert Redford who are trying to place the show with a network or an outlet. And the way they want to do it, I'm very excited by, is that they want to go through the series book by book and do it in kind of a long-form arc, which, if in fact that happens, would be perfect.
Do you think your fans differ from East Coast to West Coast?
Not that much. What's always interesting to me is what different questions I get on coast to coast. So many of them are about Wyoming and the Mountain West and the culture and the society, whereas in the Mountain West, they're more about the current issue that's in the book. So it just kind of depends.
What's next for you?
I have a standalone called Badlands that's set in the oil boom of North Dakota, and it's going to come out end of July this year. I'm really excited about that book.
Well, we'll certainly look forward to it. CJ, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Bye.
And now let's listen to a sampling of Endangered, performed by David Chandler.
Fat tire tracks churned through the sagebrush, crushing some plants and snapping others at their woody stalks. Spent 12-gauge shotgun shells littered the ground. Federal foreshot. He speared one through its open end with his pen and sniffed. It still smelled of gunpowder. He retrieved 18 spent shells and bagged them. Later, after he'd sealed the evidence bag, he found 2 more shells. Since 18 shells were more than a representative sample, he tossed the 2 errant casings into the back of his pickup. There was a single empty Coors Light can on the northeast corner of the site. He bagged it and tagged it, and hoped the forensics lab in Laramie could pull prints from the outside or DNA from the lip. Problem was, the can looked much older than the spent shotgun shells, and he couldn't determine if it hadn't simply been discarded along the road a few weeks prior to the slaughter. Joe guessed that the incident had occurred either the night or day before, because the exploded carcasses hadn't yet been picked over by predators. Small spores of blood in the dirt hadn't yet dried black. Whoever had done it had shot them on the lek, a lek being an annual gathering of the birds where the males strutted and clucked to attract females for breeding. The lek was a concentric circle of birds with a strutting male grouse in the center of it. Some leks were so large and predictable that locals would drive out to the location to watch the avian meat market in action. The birds bred in mid-March, nested, and produced chicks in June. If someone was to choose the most opportune time to slaughter an entire flock, this was it, Joe knew. So Lek 64, as it had been designated by a multi-agency team of biologists charged with counting the number of healthy groupings within the state, was no more. Joe took a deep breath and put his hands on his hips. He was angry, and he worked his jaw. It would take hours to photograph the carcasses and measure and photograph the tire tracks. He knew he'd have to do it himself because the county forensics tech was an hour away, provided the tech was on call and would even respond to a game violation. Joe knew he was responsible for the gathering of all evidence to send to the state lab in Laramie, and it would have to get done before the snow that was falling on top of the mountains worked its way east and obscured the evidence. Since it was Friday and the lab technicians didn't work over the weekend, at best he'd hear something by the end of next week. He'd find whoever did this, he thought. It might take time, but he'd find the shooter or shooters. Fingerprints on the brass of the shells, tire analysis, the beer can, gossipy neighbors or a drunken boast would lead him to the bad guys. Sometimes it was ridiculously easy to solve these kinds of crimes, because the kind of person who would leave such a naked scene often wasn't very smart. Joe had apprehended poachers in the past by finding photos of them posing with dead game on Facebook posts, or by looking at the taxidermy mounts in their homes, or by simply going to their front door, knocking, and saying, "I guess you know why I'm here." It had been amazing what kinds of answers that inquiry sometimes brought. But he wasn't angry because of the work ahead of him. There was also that special directive recently put out by Governor Roulon and his agency director about sage grouse. Preserving them, that is. Game and fish biologists and wardens had been ordered to pay special attention to where the grouse were located and how many there were. The status of the sage-grouse population, according to Roulon, was pivotal to the future economic well-being of the state.
That was Endangered by C.J. Box. J.A. Jantz shows revenge isn't the only dish served cold in her new thriller, Cold Betrayal. Allie Reynolds' longtime friend, taser-carrying nun Sister Anselm, rushes to the bedside of a young pregnant woman hospitalized for severe injuries after she'd been hit by a car on a deserted Arizona highway. The girl had been running away from the family, a polygamous cult with no patience for those who try to leave its ranks. Something about the woman strikes a chord in Sister Anselm, reminding her of a case she worked years before, when another young girl wasn't so lucky. Meanwhile, married life agrees with Allie, but any hopes she and her husband will finally slow down and relax are dashed when Allie's new daughter-in-law approaches her, desperate for help. The girl's grandmother, Betty, is in danger. She's been receiving anonymous threats. Someone even broke into her home and turned on the gas burners in the middle of the night. But the local police think the elderly woman's just not as sharp as she used to be. Allie and Sister Anselm race against the clock to uncover secrets the family had hidden for so long before someone comes back to bury them forever. Karen Ziemba performs the book.
Other people in the room might think he was just joshing her, but she knew there was more to it than that. Yes, he was teasing, but he also meant it. After their high school romance came undone, they had both gone on to love and marry other people. But the connection forged by young love remained a glowing ember in both their lives. "I'm sick and tired of these Minnesota winters," Marcia was saying. "My one daughter keeps inviting me to come live with her in Florida, but I don't think I could handle all that heat and humidity. Besides, she takes care of her four grandkids when her daughter is at work. I definitely couldn't handle living in that kind of chaos." Again, Betsy said nothing. Her own son, Jimmy, was a dentist right here in Bemidji, but she wouldn't live with him on a bet, not ever, because living with him would also mean living with his wife, Sandra. Never to be referred to as Sandy, by the way. That was one reason Betsy didn't want to move into assisted living in town. Being in town meant that she would be living that much closer to Jimmy and Sandra, giving them that much more opportunity to stick their very unwelcome noses into her business. Betsy's granddaughter, Athena, had made it clear that Betsy was welcome to come live with her family in Sedona. Betsy adored Athena, and her husband, Chris, was clearly a treasure. Their twins, Colin and Colleen, were cute as buttons, and when it came to living with little kids, Betsy was on the same page as Marcia. Having grandkids and great-grandkids come to visit was great. Twins were especially good when it came to bragging rights over bingo cards, but living under the same roof with them? Nope, that wasn't going to happen. "I'd hate it if you moved away," Betsy said. "If I didn't have you to take me back and forth to bingo, I wouldn't have any idea about what's really going on in town." For Betsy, playing bingo was the least important part of going. Gossip was the central purpose of those Monday night gatherings. Whose kid had been sent to jail or gotten out of jail? Whose grandson had joined the Marines? Whose granddaughter had staged a big church wedding, even though her baby bump was clearly visible to all concerned? Whose daughter had been picked up for dealing drugs in Minneapolis? All those little tidbits were grist for the bingo gossip mill. "It's a shame about Tess Severson's older son," Marcia added. "This has to be the fourth or fifth time he's been through rehab. Maybe this time it'll take." "I hope so," Betsy said. "It's got to be tough on his wife and kids."
"I'll say," Marcia agreed. "Why his wife sticks with him is more than I can understand."
With that, Marcia turned on to Last Road, the one that led to Betsy's farm. For a long time, their road had been the Last Road. But the name had become official only a few years earlier, when all the country lanes, most of which had been nameless before, were assigned names. Sometime after that, the intersecting road was extended as far as the new gravel pit. At that point, Last Road had stopped being Last, but the name stuck. Betsy's late husband, Alton, had loved having Last Road as part of their official mailing address, and it had certainly been the last road for him. Betsy suspected that despite Howard's sly invitation, Last Road would most likely be the last one for her, too. She had scattered Alton's ashes on the farm, and that was where Betsy had asked to have her own ashes scattered as well. At least that's what it said in the final directions part of her will, right along with her "Do Not Resuscitate" directive. "Here we are," Marcia said, turning into the driveway and skidding to a stop in front of the house. The snow was already starting to stick. Betsy knew that beneath the thin crust of snow was a thick base coat of ice that would make for treacherous walking. She had meant to ask Harold, her next-door neighbor and general handyman, to come by and apply de-icer to the walkway after that last bout of freezing rain, but she hadn't quite gotten around to it. Before she left for bingo, she had left the porch light switched on, and the lamps in the living room were lit as well. Leaving lights on when they were away for an evening was the kind of extravagance Alton never would have tolerated.
We've just heard Cold Betrayal by J.A. Jantz. Winner of the Tony Hillerman Prize, Bad Country by C.B. McKenzie, focuses on a former rodeo cowboy turned private investigator. Rodeo Grace Garnett lives alone in a remote corner of Arizona, known to locals as The Hole. He doesn't get many visitors, but a body found near his home has drawn the police to his front door. The victim is a member of one of the local Indian tribes. Retired from the rodeo circuit and scraping by as a PI, Rodeo doesn't have much choice but to say yes when offered this unusual case. An elderly Indian woman hires him to help find who murdered her grandson, but she seems strangely uninterested in the results. Her indifference seems heartless, but Rodeo soon learns that it's nothing compared to true hatred. Mark Bramall performs the book.
Rodeo turned away from the cop and waited for a minute for his dog to catch up to him, bent and scratched the dog's ears. "You are a real trooper, aren't you, boy?" Rodeo asked. "Yes, sir." "I was talking to the dog, Mr. Anderton." Rodeo stood. His dog whined. Rodeo turned to the state policeman. "You running a rogue investigation, Mr. Anderton?" Rodeo asked. "That what you're really doing out here in the middle of no place? You think Sheriff Molina's not doing something he ought to be doing?" "I didn't say anything against Sheriff Molina," said Anderton. "You here for some specific reason, then?" "I want you to take a look at something, Mr. Garnett." The cop reached into his vehicle and pulled a manila folder from the dash. Rodeo opened the screen door of his casita and followed his dog inside and left the door open for the state trooper. The cop entered the little house and moved around the central room, peering where he could, until Rodeo motioned him into a straight-backed chair at the table. Rodeo put fresh water in the dog's bowl and tipped what was left of a 20-pound bag of generic dog food in the dog's dish. The dog sniffed at the powdery food, but didn't eat any of it, only lapped wearily at the bowl of water, and then looked up at Rodeo and whined. Rodeo pulled a fifth of Green Label Jack Daniels from a cabinet and tipped a taste of the light liquor into the dog's water, then recapped the bottle and put it away without offering it around. "You give your dog liquor?" asked Anderton. "They say it's bad to drink alone," Rodeo said. The dog drank for a while, then walked under the kitchen table, circled three times, lay down, and went almost immediately to sleep on the floor. Rodeo lit a propane burner with a wood match and watched the cowboy coffee pot. He slid the .357 Magnum out of the leather holster on his belt and placed it on the countertop. "Have there been any rubberneckers around the vicinity this morning, Mr. Garnett?" Anderton asked. "Has anyone driven out to view the murder scene by your gate? spectators of the crime scene?
Just you, Mr. Anderton. Coffee?
I have water in my vehicle, Anderton said. The AZDPS cop opened the folder and extracted a single sheet of color photocopy paper on which was a set of photographs. He stood and moved forward to place the set of images on the kitchen table. Can you identify any of the objects pictured here, sir?
Why are you asking?
I understand your caution, Mr. Garnett, but this is not part of any official inquiry.
That makes it less likely, not more likely, that I'll discuss this evidence, said Rodeo.
If this is crime scene evidence you're showing me, Mr. Anderton? Anderton tapped one of the photocopied images with a buffed fingertip.
This is the object we discovered under the body of the man who was murdered near your property line, the cop said.
You'll remember Sheriff Molina was asking whether it was wood or metal. Actually, it's ironwood. Tourist trinkets are made of this material and sold by the Seri Indians, who traditionally inhabit areas around Kino Bay on the Sea of Cortez in Mexico. Seri are typically diminutive people, as was the Vic by your gates.
Rodeo drank his coffee. The traffic cop tapped the page again.
This is a comb, he said. Probably something the Navajo would use making wool. The policeman pointed at another image. And this is a fragment of a water jar, probably an antique one. Virtually all Native American tribes have made water jars over the centuries, so it would take an expert to identify the specific mud used in order to verify the production site. He touched another image. And then this one is a small gourd rattle. Again, a wide variety of Native American tribes have and use these for ceremonial purposes, like the sweat lodge ceremony or traditional dances, though mostly they are produced for the tourist trade currently.
Were these objects found at the current murder scenes in Los Haros? Asked Rodeo.
I can't say, said the policeman. I was just wondering if you had any ideas, Mr. Garnett, about any of these artifacts. Do any of them seem familiar to you?
We've just heard Bad Country by C.B. McKenzie. The Sun by Philip Meyer was selected as a 2014 Audi Award finalist for literary fiction. Part Texas epic, part classic coming-of-age story, part portrait of the bloody price of power, The Sun maps the legacy of violence in the American West through the lives of the McCulloughs, an ambitious family as resilient and dangerous as the land they claim. Spring, 1849. Eli McCullough is 13 when a marauding band of Comanches takes him captive. Brave and clever, Eli quickly adapts to the life among the Comanches, learning their ways and waging war against their enemies, including white men. But when disease, starvation, and overwhelming numbers of armed Americans decimate the tribe, Eli finds himself alone. Neither white nor Indian, civilized nor fully wild, he must carve a place for himself in a world in which he does not fully belong. An ensemble cast performs this adventurous journey of tragedy, grit, and luck.
The shooting could be heard as soon as it got dark. Near midnight, about 50 men came to the gate carrying torches, shouting for us to turn over the Mexicans. They hesitated there in the road. 50 men or not, it is no small thing to trespass on McCullough land. But after a long period of milling around, one of them put his foot on the bar and began to climb over. At which point we opened fire over their heads. Charles put his automatic Remington to good use, unleashing all 15 rounds as the crowd broke and fled down the road. We spent a good deal of time afterwards stomping out the fires that started when they dropped their torches. Later, Niles Gilbert and two others from the Law and Order League drove up and pleaded with me to kick the Mexicans out, lest the town be burned. Charles shouted, "So go shoot the a**s who are burning your town! It ain't like you don't have enough guns." "How many men do you have, Peter?" "I've got enough, and I've armed all the Mexicans as well," which was not true. "This isn't going to turn out well for you," he said. Consuela and Sullivan had been cooking all night, so there was plenty of beef and cabrito. By morning, half the families had asked permission to stay at the ranch until the town was safe. The other half loaded up with food and water and began to walk or ride across our pastures toward the river in Mexico. They are going into a war zone, but apparently it is preferable to this. Naturally, they all believe the colonel is responsible for their salvation. Who else could it be but Don Eli? This rankles greatly, but I did not bother to correct them. How they will ever get democracy, I don't know. They are very comfortable with the idea that powerful men rule their lives. Or perhaps they are simply more honest about it than we allow ourselves to be. My father was well-behaved, entertaining all the children on the gallery with his Indian stories, showing them how to start a fire with two sticks, giving archery demonstrations as well. He can still draw his old Indian bow, which I can barely pull back myself. He was happy and at ease and laughed a lot. I do not remember seeing him like this since before my mother died. Perhaps he was meant to be a schoolteacher. As we watched the refugees walking and riding toward the river, their belongings piled on mules and carts, he said, "That'll be the last time we see any of them moving south, I'd imagine." And yet they love him. They go back to their jacals at night, which are hot in the summer and cold in the winter, while he goes back to our house, a sprawling white monstrosity, 1,000 years' salary for them, or 1,000,000. Meanwhile, their children are stillborn, and they bury them near the corrals. Who are you to say they ain't happy? That is what a white man will tell you. Looking you straight in the eye as he says it. After the largest group of Mexicans left, a group of us went door to door in town and gave everyone we didn't recognize 5 minutes to be on their way. Campbell put up new signs. Anyone carrying a firearm will be shot and or arrested. By 6 o'clock, the streets were deserted. 14 houses have been burned. Sergeant Campbell is leaving tomorrow to get medical attention for his wounds. Apparently, he has gotten quite a hiding for not going south to protect the big ranches. 200 sections is considered middling. But thanks to Guillermo's sugar remedy, his arm does not appear to be getting any worse. To help me relax, I read the newspapers for the first time in a week. A storm hit Galveston yesterday, killing 300. A great victory, as the last one killed 10,000, ending Galveston's reign as our state's queen city. Sally called at 5 a.m. Glenn's fever appears to have broken.
We've just heard The Sun by Philip Meyer. After trying to help Benjamin Pearl, an undernourished, nearly feral 11-year-old boy living in the Montana wilderness, social worker Pete Snow comes face to face with the boy's profoundly disturbed father, Jeremiah. With courage and caution, Pete slowly earns a measure of trust from this paranoid survivalist itching for a final conflict that will signal the coming end times. But as Pete's own family spins out of control, Pearl's activities spark the full-blown interest of the FBI, putting Pete at the center of a massive manhunt from which no one will emerge unscathed. In Fourth of July Creek, Smith Henderson explores the complexities of freedom, community, suspicion, and anarchy. McLeod Andrews and Jenna Lamia perform the book.
He pounds on the door, no response, cups his eyes to see in the window. Sounds like the argument has spilled out the back door of the house. The neighbor jogs around to the side gate where the boy is standing with his air rifle. The two of them halt at the sight of one another. Then the kid starts crossing and uncrossing his eyes at the neighbor. To unnerve him, or because he'd at last gone bonkers, who could say? Did he actually threaten the neighbor with the gun? The cop blew smoke out his nose. This guy, he knows a pellet gun when he sees it. Right. But it ain't like he pointed the gun at the guy or said anything threatening at him exactly. The neighbor says he was more worried about the kid going after the mother. Pete nodded and wrote some more. So then what? So he says, "F*** it," and calls it in. And the situation when you got here? The situation was a perfect mess. The situation was the kid climbing up onto the slanted, dented aluminum carport and stomping on the rusted thing like an ape, just making the whole unsound shelter boom and groan under his weight. The mother's saying, so help her, if that thing falls on her charger, she'll gut him. And the kid just swagging the carport back and forth so that it was popping and starting to bow under his weight. Now the cop was about ready to shoot the ornery off the thing. Then the situation got interesting. The mother has the air rifle and... No way, Pete said. Yeah, way, the cop said. She shoot him? Before I get to her, yeah, she shoots. You can see the big old welt on his forearm. Pete started to write. And then what? Then the kid leaps off the carport just as the cop has taken the air rifle and ordered the woman inside. But the kid and his mother are already tearing at each other like two wet cats in a sack. Right in front of a cop, mind you. Like he ain't even there. All the neighbors are out on their nice, normal lawns in their bathrobes, clutched closed at the neck, watching the cop trying to disentangle the two of them. Taking it in like the rodeo. And the bitch, pardon my French, the cop at last says about all his cussing, won't desist, and the kid won't desist. So the cop wrangles the first one he can get a hand on, the woman, it turns out, and wrestles her onto her belly and into the cuffs. But not before the kid makes a run to kick her in the face, which the cop just barely stops with his own body. And realizing he's just kicked one seriously pissed off police officer in the chest, the dumb turns tail and flees. And you ran him down, Pete said. Smoke leaked out the cop's pale yellow smile. See that pickup? He asked. Yeah. So he's looking back to see if I'm coming. And he runs smack into the open tailgate. I imagine that was satisfying. Your words, brother. The cop took a drag and blew it at the ground. Anyhow, by the time I get him up on the porch, she's blubbering about how she has a social worker who knows the whole history of everything and would straighten them out. Please, please, what I call the social worker, she says. Pete nodded and wrote. His arm was tired, so he bent to finish with the clipboard on his thigh. The cop said something. I'm sorry, Pete said. So, what's going on with these two? The cop asked again. Pete scoffed. Not at the question, but at the enormity of the answer. How to sketch it, shorthand it. A great many things were going on with them. Went on, and would keep going on. The mother collected unemployment, but her full-time occupation was self-pity. She slippered around the house in sweatpants and smoked a lot of weed and took speed and tugged her hair over her face in a shape pleasing and temporary and dumped forth her old bosom and smiled prettily for herself and discovered nothing in the mirror to recommend her to anybody for anything. Or so you could imagine, the way she mooned her eyes at you until you told her to knock it off. You wanted to talk about the children. She ventured out only to get her SSI check and visit her dealer somewhere up on the edge of the Yak Wilderness, sometimes to get cereal.
That was 4th of July Creek by Smith Henderson. Ten years ago, Craig Johnson wrote his first short story, the Hillerman Award-winning Old Indian Trick. This was one of the earliest appearances of the sheriff who would go on to star in Johnson's best-selling novels and the A&E hit series Longmire. Each Christmas thereafter, Johnson sent out a new short story featuring an episode in Walt's life that never appeared in the novels. Over the years, many fans have asked why they can't buy the stories in book form. Wait for Signs collects these beloved stories and one new story, Petunia, Banded Queen of the Bighorns, for the first time in a single volume. Wait for Signs, performed by the wonderful George Goodall, is a welcome addition to any Longmire fan's shelf and a great way to introduce new readers to the fictional world of Absaroka County, Wyoming.
The Blue Cow had been a restaurant longer than it had been a casino. Its Montana breakfast, served all day, as featured in Reader's Digest, consisted of a half pound of bacon, 4 jumbo eggs, 12 pancakes, 3/4 of a pound of hash browns, a pint of orange juice, and endless coffee. A Western epic, well known across the High Plains. We had gotten a late start, The sun was already sinking over the rolling hills of the Little Bighorn country and was casting surrealistic shadows against the one-ton hay bales of the Indian ranchers. It was September, and with the sporadic rain of a cool August, it looked like everybody was going to get a third cutting. We rolled the windows half down and made Dog stay in the truck. I lifted Lonnie, placed the legless man in his wheelchair, and rolled him in. He smiled at the remains of the day and picked up a free Shoshone Shopper newspaper as we passed through the double glass doors into the restaurant. I wheeled the old Cheyenne Indian to a booth by the window, where I could keep an eye on the truck and on Dog, and where we could hear Montana Slim singing Round Up in the Fall through his nose on a radio in the kitchen. 1948 8N tractor. Only $1,200. He held his gray and black hair back with a suntanned, wrinkled hand. Comes with a Dearborn front-end loader. I tipped my hat back, pulled a menu from the napkin holder, and looked at the tiny rainbows at the corners of his thick glasses. I don't need a tractor, Lonnie. It is a good price. Yes, it is so. I nodded, tossed the menu on the table, and glanced around. You think there's anybody here? He blinked and looked over my shoulder toward the cash register. My gaze followed his. Two sets of eyes stared at us just above the surface of the worn-out, wood-grained Formica counter.
That was Wait for Signs by Craig Johnson. Today's book report final select is Scott Eiman's new biography of the most famous cowboy of all, John Wayne. The Duke epitomized the Western film, which for many people epitomized America. Wayne identified with conservative political causes from the early 1930s to his death in 1979, making him a hero to one generation of Americans and a villain to another. But unlike fellow actor Ronald Reagan, Wayne had no interest in politics as a career. Like many stars, he altered his life story, claiming to have become an actor almost by accident, when in fact he'd studied drama and aspired to act for most of his youth. He married three times, all to Hispanic women, and conducted a lengthy affair with Marlena Dietrich. More than 30 years after his death, he remains the standard by which male stars are judged. Scott Eiman interviewed Wayne, as well as many family members, and he's drawn on previously unpublished reminiscences from friends and associates of the Duke. He also studied documents from his production company that sheds light on Wayne's business affairs. Eiman analyzes Wayne's relationship with John Ford, the director with whom he's most associated and who made some of Wayne's greatest films. Wayne was self-aware. He once said, "I've played the kind of man I'd like to have been." John McClane narrates.
The scene had a problem, and the problem was the gun. Dudley Nichols' script was specific. There is the sharp report of a rifle, and Curly jerks up his gun as Buck saws wildly at the ribbons. The stagecoach comes to a lurching stop before a young man who stands in the road beside his unsaddled horse. He has a saddle over one arm and a rifle carelessly swung in the other hand. It is Ringo. "Ringo, you might need me in this Winchester. I saw a couple of ranches burning last night." Curly: "I guess you don't understand, kid. You're under arrest." Ringo, with charm: "I ain't arguing about that, Curly. I just hate to part with a gun like this." Holding it by the lever, he gives it a jerk, and it cocks with a click. John Ford loved the dialogue, which was in and of itself unusual, but the introduction of the Ringo kid needed to be emphasized. Ford decided that the shot would begin with the actor doing something with the gun. Then the camera would rapidly track in from a full-length shot to an extreme close-up, an unusually emphatic camera movement for the period, and an extremely unusual one for Ford, who had grown to prefer a stable camera. Since the actor was already coping with two large props, Ford decided to lose the horse. He told his young star what he was planning to do. "Work out something with the rifle," Ford said, "or maybe just a pistol." He wasn't sure. And just like that, the problem was dropped in the lap of his star, a young, but not all that young, actor named John Wayne, better known to Ford and everybody else as Duke. Wayne ran through the possibilities. Every actor in Westerns could twirl a pistol, so that was out. Besides, the script specified a rifle cocked quickly with one hand, but later in the scene than what Ford was planning. In addition, Ford wanted him to do something flashy, but it couldn't happen too quickly for the audience to take it in. All the possibilities seemed to cancel each other out. And then, Yakima Canutt, Wayne's friend and the stunt coordinator on the film, offered an idea. When Canutt was a boy, he had seen Buffalo Bill's Wild West show. As the Overland stage raced around the arena, a messenger trailing behind the stagecoach had carried a rifle with a large ring loop, which allowed him to spin the rifle in the air, cocking it with one hand. The crowd went wild. Canutt said that it had been 30 years ago, and he still remembered the moment. More to the point, he had never seen anybody else do it. Wayne sparked to the idea, as did Ford, but first they had to make it work. Ford instructed the prop department to manufacture a ring loop and install it on a standard-issue 1892 Winchester carbine. After the rifle was modified, Wayne began experimenting with the twirl move as Canutt remembered it. But there was a problem. The barrel of the rifle was too long. It wouldn't pass cleanly beneath Wayne's arm. The Winchester went back to the prop department, where they sawed an inch or so off the end, then soldered the sight back on the shortened barrel. With that minor adjustment, the move was suddenly effortless. Wayne began rehearsing the twirling movement that would mark his entrance in the movie he had been waiting more than 10 years to make. A film for John Ford, his friend, his mentor, his idol, the man he called Coach, or alternately, and more tellingly, Pappy. With any luck at all, he'd never have to go back to B-Westerns as long as he lived.
We've just heard John Wayne by Scott Eyman. Readers, I hope you've enjoyed our spotlight on the men and women who embody the famed cowboy quote, "Do not go where the path may lead. Go instead where there is no path and leave a trail." And speaking of quotes, were you able to identify the source of our quote from the start of today's show? "There is something about the outside of a horse that is good for the inside of a man." You were wrong if you attributed it to the Duke, but you were right if you thought it was Sir Winston Churchill. Be sure to check bookreportradio.com for great new titles across the genres. Thanks so much for joining me today. Let's meet again in a week for the next edition of The Book Report. And happy trails.